Hello, and thank you for listening to Whom Pods Destroy, a Star Trek discussion podcast. I'm Terry DeFellin. If you're a first-time listener, then welcome. This is a podcast that focuses on episodes and aspects of Star Trek, the original series. I am the host, and I'm joined by Graham Sibley and Derek Mantle. In this edition, we discuss the second season episode By Any Other Name, the story of the Kelvins, all-powerful, all-conquering, multi-tentacled invaders from the Andromeda Galaxy that can't hold their liquor. This story starts off pretty dark, before taking a turn for the decidedly comic. It is most famous for Scotty's It's Green line, in which was paid homage to in the Next Generation episode Relics. We're anxious to hear from listeners with their opinions, so do feel free to get in touch with us. Contact details will be read out at the end of the show.
Now, Whom Pods Destroy.
A series of bizarre and exotic images bursting on my mind and consciousness. Colors, shapes, mathematical equations fused and blurred. I've been attempting to isolate them, but so far I've been able to recall clearly only one. Immense beings. 100 limbs which resemble tentacles, minds of such controlling capacity that each limb is capable of performing a different function.
Hello and welcome to the program.
Us bickering already.
You join us bickering about ownership of gags, which is the sort of thing that happens when you record too many podcasts. I'm Terry and I'm joined by Derek.
Hello.
And by Graham.
Hello.
And we're going to be talking about By Any Other Name. That is right, isn't it? By Any Other Name.
Yes.
That's the one that we're doing this time around. Yep, absolutely marvellous. Okay, so By Any Other Name, second season of the original series, and it features Rojan and the Kelvins. Kelvins, I should say, not the Kelvins. That's another thing altogether. We're not going into that. Not for at least, I insist upon another 50 episodes before we mention the term Kelvin again, frankly. We need to be well bedded in. Rojan and his Kelvin buddies are seeking to invade the galaxy from the Andromeda. You know, they're originally from the Andromeda Galaxy, and they hijack the Enterprise, and hijinks ensue. I guess the first question to ask about this is about the Kelvins themselves. Multi-limbed creatures, huge. Multi-limbed creatures compacted into human bodies.
H.P. Lovecraft,
yeah? So more evidence that Star Trek exists within the Lovecraft universe, can we say that? Can we make that official now?
Well, at least in the Lovecraft galaxy.
Yes.
Maybe the Andromeda galaxy is... Maybe that is the common shape of things in the Andromeda galaxy.
Lovecraft's universe was all about multi-dimensions, though, wasn't it? These creatures, I think. I haven't read... Maybe you know better, but...
Not necessarily multi-dimensions. No? It's more to do with the... when H.P. Lovecraft was being informed growing up, he was into his science and stuff like this. And the thing is that all the different leaps of understanding how the universe worked, yeah. He basically came up with that sort of feeling in his fiction, which is a mixture of gothic and basically a great human fear of the nothingness of the universe. That's what I get from him, is that the thing is, human beings are so infinitely small for the great unknown that's out there. And the blackness, of the great voids between things, and there are things even bigger out there that look down at us as being small, infinite, little.
I am reminded of something that's from another series of Star Trek, and that's an episode of Q Who, which is when we first meet the Borg, and Q explains to Picard the nature of the universe, or gives him a glimpse of just how wonderful and terrifying it is. Beyond there, and we're obviously discussing the original series, but Graham, do you think that we can therefore take anything that happens in Lovecraft as part of Star Trek canon? Do you think we could bring that all in, import Lovecraft into Star Trek? Would that be helpful, do you think?
I think as much as any writer will always be looking at quality stuff to bring into whatever they're producing, then yeah, why not? Go for it. Cherry pick whatever you damn well please, really. And I think when you've got writers who have been not just you know, informed by reading Lovecraft, but by actually informed by meeting the guy and actually discussing writing, like people like Bob Block didn't write this episode, but he wrote three other episodes for Star Trek.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a bit of Block going on here. I mean, we should remind ourselves of what our little girl's made of, shouldn't we?
Yeah.
Ted Cassidy's Rock.
Yes, that
discussing
was it, yes.
The old ones, yeah. With Kirk in that episode. We've done an episode about that episode.
We have indeed.
Listeners, newer listeners, can go back and have a listen to that.
Yeah, we got a bit sidetracked by the costumery in the episode.
We did. Well, in fairness, we could easily get a bit sidetracked by the costumery in this episode.
Yeah,
but let's not run before we can walk, eh? Jerome Bixby, the writer of this particular episode, although I understand, well, from reading up on it, it looks like it was pretty heavily rewritten by DC Fontana, Dorothy Fontana. That would be no surprise to anyone who's listened to this podcast on irregularity. We often end up saying things like, but we understand it was heavily rewritten by DC Fontana / Gene Coon / Gene Roddenberry. They were obviously the script doctors of these things. The premise of the episode is bleak, though, guys. Two crew members are reduced to what size shapes are they?
Well, polyhedrons, aren't they?
Cuboid.
Polyhedrons, but yes, but
compact shapes, as Rojan called them, presumably because he didn't know how to pronounce what they actually were.
But I remember watching this first time round during the 70s on an old black and white television screen. You know, so I was probably about eight or something like that. So it was, and being really disturbed by it.
Really?
Know? Yeah, I was. I was. You know, the idea that sort of like someone can be, you know, completely destroyed, because that's what happens, is that one of the two crew members that are actually turned into or neutralized as a way of punishing Kirk and the rest of the crew for their trying to escape, as they usually do. And I just remember it was very bleak, the idea that sort of someone is just completely and utterly destroyed there and just crushed in someone's hand. And that's always in my head, that sort of...
You've actually awoken a bit of a memory myself, actually. Now, I've seen it so many times that you sometimes forget about the first time watching, but I think I do remember that also, and remember that it's a chilling concept, isn't it, Graham, to be reduced to such a shape and then to just simply be just snuffed out.
Yeah, but it's actually a concept that we see every week in Star Trek, because we can see the fact of what you've got is you've got people reduced down to their bare materials and then reformed again. And of course that happens every time they step into a transporter.
How true.
If you read things that try to tie in real science with the fiction of Star Trek, you get people saying, well, the transporters are really difficult to get your heads around, because the concept of reducing matter to energy and then reforming it into matter again, okay, that's something that you could probably do if you have stupid amounts of energy and stupid amounts of power and stupid amounts of computer programs to be able to actually store all that information. But the whole thing of doing it to a living thing, where someone's, for want of a word, soul or spirit is also contained in that and then rebuilt somewhere else, it's that there's no difference between these polyhedrons and the buffers that are in the transporter.
Can I go back to that?
Please.
I mean, you're dead right, and there's a story I read a couple of years ago by an author called China Melville, who, funny enough, there's a new series on BBC starting very shortly called The City in the City, and that's one of his stories, and I recommend we should all watch that. But in one of the stories that he wrote, which has a connection to this, it has a connection to H.P. Lovecraft as well. But there is a Star Trek fan who has somehow wished up all of his items that he's bought over the years, and magic is involved, and they actually become real objects. So like a phaser actually works, his transporter actually works as well. But what we find out, this is the twist in the tale, is that each time he uses the transporter, he actually has to destroy himself, because your whole body is actually taken apart and they're reconstituted somewhere else. So you actually are dying each time you are transported. And this, because it's a magical story, he starts to get haunted by all of himself.
Oh, that's genius. That's genius.
And it turns him mad completely.
That concept is not new, although that take on it is, I've not heard that. I mean, James Blish wrote in the first ever Star Trek original novel called Spock Must Die. The first chapter is dedicated to Dr. McCoy debating with the other members of the crew what happens when you transport. Do you actually die? And what happens to your soul afterwards? And it's a really interesting, and obviously it's James Blish, so it's a very well written chapter that acts as a bit of a prologue before they get underway. The idea of reducing yourself to these component parts, I think, does it play into perhaps to the theme of the episode as well, which is about humanity and about being human and coping, albeit in fairly sort of generic sort of like fashion, coping with the challenges and the benefits and the drawbacks of being human. And that, do you think that perhaps unwittingly or otherwise, the idea that in fact, when you break us down, we can all be consumed, we can all be confined into little shapes, little objects, and that this is our essence, but it is not our whole?
No, well, it is the whole sort of philosophical thing about life anyway, which is like we all return to dust, and this is, it's showing that in a much more accelerated form here. Yes. Usually when people get vaporized in Star Trek, you don't see anything. They just disappear. They glow for a little bit, and then they nothing is left of them.
Mm-hmm.
You might get a rather off color remark about someone saying, "Well, yeah, you're breathing them in now."
Don't get many bodies in Star Trek.
No, you don't. You don't. In more modern versions of it, there were things like disintegration residue and things like that. That was as it became a lot more procedural.
Well, the Horta actually. I mean, when the Horta kills people, it's like a big mucky bits of
a bit of a shadow, isn't there?
Yeah. It's Yeoman Thompson. Sorry, yes, it's Yeoman Thompson who unfortunately is the unfortunate victim. Julie Cobb is the actress. Daughter of Lee J. Cobb, the director. First and only, I think, female red shirt to die.
And it's quite stark, because they're basically put up in a firing squad. It's not like a battle scene. This is a murder. And actually the scene is multi-layered version of problematic, isn't it, really? Because you can see what they've done with this, because both of them get turned into polyhedrons.
Yeah.
And then one of them's killed. And then one of them is reconstituted again. And it's the black boy. And it's almost like the director is feeling very clever for himself for saying, "Oh, you thought it was the black guy who was going to get killed here, wouldn't it? But no, we killed the woman. How terrible are we?"
Yeah. Meanwhile, the three white guys watching on are all fine, by the way.
Yeah.
And are among the
white
ones.
Privilege. They go all the way through.
There you go. Yeah. It's a puzzling message, to be sure. I'm sure it was probably the best intentions, but you have a.
Well, I did have trouble with that scene. I had trouble with the end of it and the consequences later on, because the thing is that, having a crew member, especially with Kirk's, one of his people he's supposed to be looking after, murdered in front of him. Throughout the thing is that when we end with this series, I mean, a story, when we go to the end of it, there's no consequences for these powerful beings. They've killed someone, and they've probably, I don't know if they've killed anyone else in there, we don't see that, but they've killed someone, and there's no consequences for them.
Well, that's the problem with the episode. Yeah. I think the biggest problem with the episode is that it starts off really, really dark.
Yeah.
Exceptionally dark, down to this firing squad scene. And then the second half of it is played for laughs.
It does, it's a comedy. Yeah,
it suddenly turns. Yeah, I mean the script is the original script apparently was very dark.
Mm-hmm.
It began actually on a shuttle bay, on the Enterprise shuttle bay, with Rojan and killing 13 or something like that, double figures members of the Enterprise crew, killing them. And it goes on from there. And Yeoman Thompson was selected to be a mate with Captain Kirk in order to because it was a suddenly they were going to be a multi-generational ship and they needed to reproduce. And so all of that was written out by Dorothy Fontana. And yeah, once they get off the planet, and once they get off the planet and out of the galactic barrier, then the show just takes a right turn. Up to that point, it's pretty grim. Kirk is having to obey these orders. He's having to go through the galactic barrier. He then has to watch while his bridge crew is virtually destroyed. And then there's that bleak moment where he's walking through the corridor and he's seeing all these cuboid, these shapes of it where his crew used to be and all of that. And there's this argument taking place in the mess hall, and it's all pretty grim stuff between the remaining, who is it? It's Spock, McCoy, Scotty, and Kirk, who are the only remaining crew members. And then suddenly they go, right, we have to end this, so we have to resolve this. And that's when they say, well, we're going to exploit their humanity, and we're going to do this through various means, which are actually quite amusing.
Yeah, and so that's it. You're actually watching two different
stories. So it suddenly becomes, starts off as one show, ends as a bit of a comedy.
I would have liked it to have stayed dark.
Yes,
but then again, I do like the
well, this is the problem, isn't it? Because there's the comic bits that are actually quite funny and quite amusing.
Yeah. I mean, it's not as if you can't mix dark and humour. It has been done. I mean, it works very well in Star Trek IV, for instance.
Indeed,
where the Earth is about to be destroyed, it's about to be ripped apart, and you know the but it is done well there. Here it's not. It's because it's a TV show. It's a weekly TV show, and they have to get it out.
There's no villain in Star Trek IV.
No,
there's just confusion and misunderstanding.
Yeah,
and from so I would say there's no darkness.
Well, the darkness probe doesn't have a face, does it? So no. I suppose that's it. So you can't see it as you don't see it as a villain because you just see it as a force of nature, rather than as someone with malevolent intent. Whereas as the Kelvins are got a human face, and so you can say, right, okay, you're actually being proper evil here, you're being manipulative, you're actually threatening them to go along with this, otherwise they'll kill people in front of you.
But it's interesting that Rojan tries to appeal to Kirk's sort of like a sense of camaraderie with Kirk. He tries to point out the things they have in common. I mean, down on the planet, when he says, you strike me as being the kind of guy who would suffer greatly to watch people under your command die because of your actions. And that is absolutely an aspect of Kirk's character that I think we're familiar with, aren't we?
But Kirk is very weak throughout the whole of this.
I mean, the bit where they weren't looking to destroy the ship, for example, that didn't strike me as being entirely consistent with Kirk. Even Kirk up to that point, I don't know whether you agree with that, but I mean, it's easy to think about Kirk after this episode and then think about what he might have done. So we think about that be the last battlefield where he very nearly blew up the ship. And of course in Star Trek 3, where he actually blew up the ship.
But no one who counted was on board the ship at that time when he did it.
That's true. So. But in Let That Be Your Last Battlefield, everybody was on that ship. No one had been reduced to little shapes. And he was seconds away from going through with it. Up to this point in the series, though, had we encountered a situation where Kirk was faced with that kind of choice? I'm not certain, but I think close enough. I think I think that it's consistent with Kirk's character. He would go, he would listen to that, and then Spock with Scotty and Spock briefing him and saying, you know, we can blow up the ship. You just have to say the word, and then this is all over. Obviously, we're all dead, but this situation ends. And his reaction is like, "Are you mad?" Whereas I think actually it's more consistent reaction of Kirk to go, "Right, okay, thanks," and then make a decision.
Yeah.
Which obviously he decides not to. So that was a.
I suppose though, it's going to take them so long to get back to Andromeda. It's not really Kirk's problem if the ship goes along, it is taken back to Andromeda. It's not an immediate danger.
Sure.
With everything else, every other time there has been immediate danger.
Absolutely.
And there has been something that, you know, you've got to get the ship.
Sure.
You know, well, you've got to take the ship out of some.
His decision's
hands.
Correct.
Yeah.
It's just his initial reaction is just, I would say, was a bit inconsistent. It's sort of like, you know, what are you doing? How, as if this is something that he hadn't thought of.
Yeah.
And I would have thought that maybe it would have been.
Yeah. But at that point, you see, you had a full crew as well.
Mm.
You know, they weren't like, what, I forgot what the word, neutralised as is the word that they use in there. And they had a full crew and thinking that now, okay, we're just going to be basically these, you know, these powerful beings, playthings now that are on this ship, and we're heading it a 300-year journey. So we're not going to survive, whatever happens. You know, I would have thought that he would have probably made that sort of choice, that unless there's any way out, you would have to sort of do the necessary thing, because you want to stop an invasion as well, which will happen 600 years' time.
Yeah, but you've got 300 years to stop that, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing.
That's the whole thing.
At that point, he's probably thinking,
let's give
ourselves a bit of time. You know, we can always fashion a way of destroying the ship maybe later on. Let's give ourselves some time.
I know, I'm reading too much into it. But
well,
it's like,
an interesting dilemma. And it was an interesting reaction that they had for Kirk, because I think subsequent to that. Anyway, why don't we just have a look at some of the scenarios that are played out for trying to convince, the idea is to be able to grab one of those little belt buckle things that they've got, which is the neutralizing, and seems to freeze them and reduce and neutralize them and all of that. And the idea is to get them in a position where they become weak, because they're interfacing with humanity. So it's what's the chap's name? Tomar. Who he's a glutton.
Yeah.
There's a bit of seven deadly sins going on here, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah,
there's
maybe,
a bit of gluttony.
Bit
he of likes last, his food.
Bit of envy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He likes his food. So so Scotty decides, well, if you like your food, you'll like your drinks. So he goes and gets him drunk. Which leads to the great line, of course. And it's one of Scotty's finest moments, isn't it? It's the great line and that. I mean, we can talk about the pacing of this if you want to. But he gets him drunk on Sarian brandy. And of course, his really, really old vintage scotch. And he gets him drunk on a substance which is simply called green, which, of course, the great It's Green line, which was homaged in the TNG episode Relics as well by Brent Spiner with Data. It's a great line.
I found this in Ganarum, Ganamir.
What is it?
Well, it's. It's green.
It's well remembered. And that sequence is well remembered. If nothing else, for the tremendous measurements that Scotty was pouring out.
Yeah.
I mean, that scotch that he poured out to that guy.
Well,
I mean, he filled it right up.
It is sad, because it obviously, I mean, one of the earliest signs of alcoholism is hiding alcohol around your house.
But you say inside the cistern, inside.
Yeah,
you know,
it's
got a couple
of
bottles.
Obviously, a show of a deep problem that
Scotty is a horrific alcoholic. Yeah, because he's hiding very, very old scotch. I mean, the only thing that the redeeming feature, of course, is that it's very old and he's had it for a long time.
Yeah, but then he had all those other things.
That
is probably, you know, what alcoholics sometimes have.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not an alcoholic. Look, I've kept this for ages. When he's got other forms of booze around the house.
I think I have to go along with you, Greg. There because I mean, I actually watched Relics as well last night.
Did you? Good for you.
And the thing is that scene with Brent Spiner is brilliant. Brent Spiner's brilliant in that scene with in Guinan's bar with Scotty. Obviously, that little scene is that Scotty is outraged that they drink in his future. They drink Simferhol.
I believe I may be of some assistance. Captain Scott is unaware of the existence of Synthahol.
Synthahol?
Yes, sir. It is an alcohol substitute now being served aboard starships. It simulates the appearance, taste, and smell of alcohol, but the intoxicating effects can be easily dismissed.
You're not quite human, are you?
No, sir. I am an android. Lieutenant Commander Data.
Synthetic scotch, synthetic commanders.
I believe Guinan does keep a limited supply of non-synthaholic products. Perhaps one of them would be to your liking.
What is it? It is... It is... It is green.
And, you know, he is basically, he's an alcoholic.
He's not a symphonic,
yeah.
is he?
No. Yeah, no. He's not a, symphonic.
So we've arrived upon... Yes. Yeah.
He's an alcoholic.
Can we possibly entertain the possibility that actually none of this happened? And this was just an alcoholic haze by a vision by Scotty. Because, I mean, consider this. He doesn't... Because he fails in his mission. Because although he drinks the guy under the table, he fails in delivering the guy's little buckle to the captain because he collapses.
But he had a good time drinking.
Though. Beforehand. So it kind of renders that whole little area a bit redundant, really. Because it was like, well, you know, didn't
well,
work
it's,
out.
It's like one of the many escape... plots in
that just didn't seem to work at all.
Fail.
I mean, the thing is, when Scotty wakes up, presumably, the episode is over and everyone's been reconstituted. Yeah. Does he wake up? You know, like, you know, on the floor of his quarters.
Yeah. Yeah. A bit of spittle down one side.
Maybe Tomar was left by that point.
Yeah. Well, maybe
and he gets up and he walks out the door and he just sees everyone is going about their business and he goes, did I dream that? Did I just get...
Well, you know what actually happened? I think he would have probably gone on and said, no, I'm not going
to
mention
it. He probably went straight back to work.
Yeah.
It's only until somebody went, yeah, man, that was really intense, wasn't it? What was it like being reduced to all those? And then he went, oh, jeez, thank God it actually happened. I'm not... Poor Scotty. Let's talk about... Kalinda. I think we've put it off long enough, haven't we? And Kirk's... Kirk, naturally, the principal female character in there, the way to appeal to her humanity is through sex, because she's a woman, and, you know, that's the 60s.
I mean, it's a bit more direct than that, because the thing is, the plot... the way that they want to get hold of all these things and get out is they said they have... Now that... was it Dr. McCoy... and Spock have actually worked out that because they're in these bodies after seeing Tomar eat all of that sort of those marshmallow things that he was eating, that, you know, that they are now being stimulated by being in a human body. So now what we've got to do is a direct attack by overstimulating them by either getting them drunk or basically jumping their bones.
Kirk says,
hats off to Kirk. I mean, this is a giant multi-tentacled creature he's about to get it on with. And we're like, you know, he doesn't care.
Him before.
No, I think that guy will do anything to anything.
It may not even be female.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's no reason to assume that they have genders, frankly. I mean, it is. Obviously, they do have genders. It's weird, isn't it? I mean, we live in the world we live in now, and we wouldn't. And we were just like, oh, right, of course, yeah, they're multidimensional, you know, intergalactic creatures, and of course, they have the same genders that we do. But of course, it's all, you know, it's too much for the fragile minds of the 1960s audience to cope with it, you know. Barbara Boucher is the actress who plays Kalinda, and she is, if you'll forgive me, gorgeous. She's fucking gorgeous. She's beautiful. And I mean, she's very game, and she seems to endure the whole procedure really, really well. But, I mean, and the costume, of course, it's very revealing. Mm-hmm. She's very beautiful. And, I mean, what do you think of those scenes in general? I mean, are they embarrassing? Did you cringe when you watched them, or what?
They're as awkward as most... kissing scenes with William Shatner in, aren't they? So there's nothing, you know, really too groundbreaking with any of them, really, is there? It is what it is.
Mm.
And I suppose there is a purpose to it. So there is
this... It serves the story, because the idea is actually to get Rojan worked up, to get him jealous.
Yeah, and
someone
works.
Sort
and
of like falling in on his action.
Well, no, it wasn't to get him jealous. It was
that was a happy accident.
That was a happy accident. It was to overstimulate her.
This is Spock about... helps with that, though, doesn't he? He's the one jabbing.
Well, he's the one getting under the skin of Rojan. I mean, the pacing of this is weird, because he says to Rojan when he's playing chess, "Your game is off." And you're thinking, "Well, hang on a second. You know, when did this when did this plan start?" Because, you know, you've got Scotty and Tamar in getting drunk, and then, you know, and then you've got Haynar, who every time I say Haynar, I think of Sisters of Mercy, this corrosion by Sisters of Mercy, and he's being doped up. I mean, it's all the time. Maybe time is fluctuating in between the galaxies or something
But also, you see what happens with Spock. Spock becomes sort of the main guy's Rojan's sort of confidant as such, or he's like, he's doing what he does with Kirk.
Yeah.
He's sitting down, you know, talking.
Playing chess with him.
Yeah. Playing chess with him.
On a deeper level, the Kelvins are not coping with these emotions.
Yeah.
And so they're showing their weaknesses. Kalinda is falling for these fairly obvious and, you know, advances from Kirk, which is actually a bit creepy if you think of it like that. Rojan is putting his faith in Spock, even though he has no reason to trust him. In fact, he shouldn't be trusting him because he's so emotionally immature. And so, I mean, and this is what does for them in the end. And of course, Haynar,
is a petulant child. He's a petulant child.
And the poor lady on the bridge is thinking, what the fuck is going on around here? And I'm the only one doing any bloody work. Everyone else is off snogging or fighting or playing chess. And I'm up here on the bridge and people recording a podcast. They can't even remember my bloody name. Drea,
of course. The lovely Drea.
Played by Leslie Dalton. Not related to Tim Dalton.
No.
At least I don't think so. Anyway. Right. So all of these various schemes, they tend to kind of fall apart, don't they? Actually what happens is that by happy accident, Rojan gets the knock because he feels as though Kirk's horning in on his action. And they have a fight. And Kirk persuades Rojan to do exactly the same thing that Kirk had said that they would do right at the beginning of this episode.
Yeah.
And that's go to the Federation and work something out.
Mm.
And on this occasion, Rojan says, oh, right, well, you do that. I said, well, of course I do that. I just offered it to you about 2 days ago. So in that respect, it falls apart.
Yeah,
it
becomes a bit pointless in the whole thing, really.
Yeah. But
Yeoman died. Yeah.
And people died, which is pretty grim. I mean, it's but as we know, life is cheap in Star Trek. But, I mean, for that, Dan, is it still an enjoyable episode?
As most Star Trek episodes go, there are always little bits that are good.
Yeah.
As I said, as a child, when I first watched it, I was terrified. You know, and I thought it was good. As a teenager, probably when I watched it again, I found some interesting bits to it. Now I watched it, I'm troubled by it not working properly as really good Star Trek episodes work, you know. But, you know, it's like all Star Trek, you know, you get, there are always little bits that are good. I'm sure that you can point out some episodes that are just stinkers. But,
I don't think this isn't a stinker, is it?
No, it's not a stinker.
It's not a stinker. It's good. It could have been a hell of a lot better. I think you could have played it for laughs from the start.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you could have made them powerful but ridiculous. They could be like acting like kids, basically. That's what they are. They act like teenagers. Their emotions are all out of whack, and like they can't stop eating, they can't stop snogging, and they can't stop fighting. It's like, you know, they're basically 14 years old.
Except Drea.
She's a nerdy, responsible one.
Yeah.
There's always one of them around.
But that's the thing, is when I was watching it, I actually really liked the beginning of it, when there's a hopeless scenario that Kirk and his crew have to defeat.
Mm.
And it's dark. And then we've
You would have preferred it to have stayed that way.
Well, we do love those little sequences. I mean, the Scotty sequence is great. I mean, that's the thing. That makes up for a lot of it.
Yeah, I mean, there's a difference between playing something light and then playing it just for belly laughs. And I think that there is a lot of darkness in Star Trek, but you don't, when you try to bring lightness into it, then you can. It will jar. It will jar. And I think for something that you're doing 45 minutes, you know, you've got to contain the whole thing in one episode. Just go with one idea rather than just keep going. And I think that's the problem. As soon as these old episodes start trying to get too many things in place, it doesn't work. City on the Edge of Forever is obviously, you know, lauded as probably the best episode. There are light moments in that, but it is there just to take the edge off the what is a very, very grim episode. Yeah.
And but, it's conveyed in the narrative.
And the lightness works well. The lightness is actually a relief for you to think, actually, that's all right. It's because it never takes away how dark those episodes are. With this one, it does. It's light and dark, because you start off with dark and then you're like, okay, well, that's all right. Well, yeah, for the last two acts, don't worry. It'll be belly laughs all the
way. It's too sharp a turn.
Yeah, it is.
It's funny enough, I think you've clarified something with me, because I actually thought this episode actually feels longer than a normal Star Trek episode.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's two parts.
Yeah.
And, you know, they are two different things.
Yeah.
And it does feel like the flow is interrupted. And you know, and watching it just feels like it's just over an hour, you know.
Well, it's actually only about 50 minutes or so. Digital versus original versus remastered.
From Graham.
I don't remember there being
the planet when they first being down. That establishment
bigger,
shot's changed.
Yeah, to bigger, yeah. bigger shot.
Although
there.
The set is the same, but the establishment shot is changed.
Yeah.
And then the Andromeda Galaxy obviously looks differently.
Yeah.
A brief note about the Edge of the Galaxy as well. This is the second successive episode in which we talk about the Galactic Barrier, which they go through. And again, no enhancement of telepathic abilities going through there. You know, this is the third of three, and it's only in the first one where we have this whole business where...
I thought about it again, though. And it was actually... Because why isn't Spock affected by this? Because he's got telepathic immunity. But has he got ESP? And I thought that's what it was actually the thing. Was it ESP?
It was extra sensory perception. Yeah,
so okay, there you go. Right. So if you want to get nerdy and think, it's not telepathy, ESP. They're completely different things, obviously.
Good
unless
sequel potential.
We don't want them to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's plenty of sequel potential in this, isn't there? We don't even know what happened to the Kelvins, where they settle down, how they get on, and whether they adopt their multi-tentacled form. And
I stumbled across a really good webcomic where there's a sequel to this, and it's really well done. And I can't credit the artist. And it's fan fiction.
Will you be able to find it again and link it on the?
I will do. I'll find it again and link it. And it is a direct sequel. It's set 300-600 years later, when the Federation is, you know, a different thing altogether. And it's really good. It's beautifully rendered, I have to say, and it's actually really, really good. And the guy is clearly very talented. Wasted on Star Trek fan fiction, bluntly. You know, if forgive me for saying so, but it clearly is very. I don't think there's anything more to add.
Is actually a question to the Star Trek experts, because it's to do with later on in Star Trek as a franchise, the quadrants. Now, when we were looking at the case of the Andromeda Galaxy and the Great Barrier, I still haven't got round my head when it comes to Star Trek, you know, as a big unit, as a continuation of the story. How the universe, how the galaxy is divided up, and also, do we actually have movement? I mean, are the quadrants different galaxies?
I'll build this one.
Come, Graham.
A wizard
hit
did
us
it.
With us.
Ah, what did you say?
A wizard did it.
A wizard did it. Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. In the original series, and really going up into TNG, the use of the word quadrants was just meant an area.
Yeah, we're the only ship in the quadrant. I understand we're the only base in the quadrant.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
and that stuff sort of like
thing. Yeah, it just meant to convey the fact that you know, you're a long way away from somewhere else.
Yeah, they didn't mean the Alpha Quadrant. No. Or the Beta Quadrant or the Delta Quadrant.
That thing came later when someone actually sat down with a piece of paper and decided. Look, I think it was probably a Michael Okuda thing, wasn't it?
Probably a Michael Okuda, and it's probably a DS9 thing, because they went, we need to be able to quantify the distance between DS9 and
actually, you know, have
the other side of the wormhole.
Terms that we can use over and over again, and not get nerds complaining about what the hell's a quadrant.
Yeah, but what I was trying to get was is that. I know, the idea that we're actually in the Milky Way, and the Federation is in the Milky Way.
Yes.
But have we had many stories that actually move to different galaxies?
No, because you had the Galactic Barrier.
And that's it.
And that's it.
All of Star Trek is really in the Milky Way.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes, indeed.
This is the furthest out we get. This is, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm wondering about, do you remember a TNG episode called Where No One Has Gone Before? It's a second or third episode.
Is this with the Traveller?
But I have a feeling that they take them into the centre of the galaxy, where it all gets weird and strange. I don't think they take them out of the galaxy, but I don't remember.
So it's quite interesting that sort of
that's
like
a cracking episode.
Going
that is,
back to the sort of right at the beginning of this podcast, we were talking about sort of the H.P. Lovecraft stuff and about the big void and how small we are. Because you see, the thing is that the scientific sort of the thing that H.P. Lovecraft brought into it is that how small we are, and the thing is that the Federation itself is just in one galaxy, and you've got all of these other galaxies that we don't really see at all. And actually, the whole of the sort of Federation and Star Trek is actually only one little tiny little bit of the universe.
Mm. And it's not really that understood at that time, because really, I mean, the whole concept of galaxies was still relatively new in the 60s. We're quite comfortable with it now, okay, but it actually still wasn't in common usage as to what that actually meant. So there were the idea there where Andromeda became irradiated. What, the whole galaxy? I mean every galaxy is irradiated with some background microwave stuff, but like, you know,
Andromeda just had a really bad smell.
Yeah. I suspect the Kelvins just had no more galaxies, no more stars left to conquer, perhaps, like Alexandra. Uh-huh. And then they went seeking other places to conquer.
Yeah.
I think I'd like to leave it there unless there's anything pressing that you would like to discuss about this 50-year-old episode of Star Trek. Yeah.
No.
Excellent. Okay, well, in that case, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much indeed for listening. Stick around, because I'll be making a few announcements afterwards. But for the time being, from myself, Terry, and from Derek and Graham, it's goodbye.
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 Thanks again for taking the time to listen to this episode of Whom Pods Destroy. Just to confirm that webcomic I mentioned is called Time's Refuge, and it's by the very talented Mark Farinas. A link to the comic is on the show notes. If you have any feedback you'd like to share with us, or would like to correct any of our wrong opinions on this episode, then do drop us a line at garth@whompodsdestroy.com. You can also get in touch with us via Twitter @whompodsdestroy. In our next episode, we visit an altogether darker place in more ways than one. So join us again as we discuss the wolf in the fold. Drea,
of course, the lovely Drea,
played by Leslie Dalton.